everybody, and welcome back to the show. I've got a great guest with me here today, Congressman Peter Meyer. Congressman, thanks so much for coming on.
I really appreciate it, Brad. Looking forward.
Yeah, so I actually first was introduced to you through my boyfriend, who is a native of Michigan and actually just outside of your district. So he's from outside of the Grand Rapids area, but pretty close. But I actually may be becoming your constituent technically sometime in the next year or two if we move back to Michigan. So you better hope this goes well, because I'll be voting for or against you in just a couple years maybe.
Well, that's too funny. And I remember I saw one of your, I think it was a Fox News interview. I was like, wait a second, that's the Grand Rapids skyline in the background.
Yeah, so I was doing a satellite hit. I was visiting my boyfriend's family there, and they put that as the backdrop because it was a local studio that I was satelliting in from. But I guess, so obviously, you are a freshman congressman. So for people who don't know, you were just elected. So to introduce yourself to listeners who might not have heard of you before, can you just tell us about your background? Who is Peter Meyer?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my background's in the military, humanitarian aid and disaster response. So, you know, I was fourth generation West Michigander, born and raised in Grand Rapids. After high school, I started at West Point. I loved the military, didn't want to make a career as a commissioned Army officer on active duty. So I ended up transferring out to Columbia. But then I enlisted in the reserve simultaneously doing military intelligence work. So I deployed to Iraq in 2010, doing intelligence operations, mainly interrogations, running sources, and a little bit of counterintelligence. And was hoping for a career in the national defense sector. Ended up spending a lot of time adjacent to that in veteran education advocacy. So I campaigned for the post 9/11 GI Bill. And then up until I ran for Congress, I was ultimately chairman of the Board of Student Veterans of America. But my main kind of career focus was in, like I said, in the military. I spent time doing humanitarian aid work in Afghanistan. I did disaster response work kind of around the globe. And then came back home, got an MBA, and got involved once more in politics, but helping elect veterans on both sides of the aisle through a group called With Honor. And it was through kind of that combination of experiences and just getting a little closer on the ground that when the seat started to open up, jumped in the fray.
Yeah, so this is interesting because I've often found a really interesting to talk to members of Congress and elected officials who have a military background about how it shaped their experience in terms of thinking about foreign policy issues. So you've been to Iraq, you've been to Afghanistan. How does that shape your view? What was that like? How does that shape your view of the U.S. approach to Middle Eastern conflicts now?
Well, I thank you for that, because I also have a relatively unique perspective, having been a combatant in Iraq and a non-combatant, you know, working in the humanitarian aid sector in Afghanistan. So I've lived on both sides of the blast wall. You know, I've carried a weapon and, you know, participated in the armed conflict. And then I've also tried to keep folks out of it and then tried to figure out how to navigate and work in the midst of an active conflict area. I'll say that I probably went to Iraq a little bit of a hawk or at least an optimist that we could have more good come out of the scenario than bad, and left pretty well disillusioned. My fundamental frustration, and I saw this in both conflicts, is just the lack of strategy, right? We have plenty of tactics. We have no real long-term vision for what we're hoping to do. But we just have these conflicts that continue on and on because we don't know where we're going. And if you don't know where you're going, any road's going to get you there.
Yeah. So this is interesting because I think this has been a paradigm shift in Republican thinking and conservative thinking, and especially among younger conservatives. I mean, I cannot remember a time in my life the United States was not at war. Mm-hmm. I grew up in the Iraq War. I cannot remember a time before the Iraq War. And that's really stunning, especially when you think of how these conflicts, I mean, most people don't disagree with like the initial decision to go into Afghanistan. They just wonder what we've been doing the last decade and a half since we wandered into just nation building territory. So I'm curious to what was it about being there and seeing how this played out that drew you to less of a hawkish perspective and made you question nation building and that kind of an approach?
You know, I think it's fundamentally the mismatch between what we say we want to do or have happen and what we're actually willing to commit to that cause, right? the, you know, Iraq obviously was a tremendous, almost criminal underestimation of what we were getting into. And we struggled to, you know, discover a rationality of what we can do to kind of to leave. Ultimately, that became forming a little bit of a government, you know, helping hopefully a transition to police primacy, you know, domestically. And now that hasn't necessarily taken root long term. You know, I was in Iraq. We were in a very precarious situation because we were ostensibly being protected by the Iraqi security forces, which were a majority Shia, while we were getting attacked by Iranian-backed militant groups, which were majority Shia. If we wanted to go and you know, put out a targeting package on a Sunni target, they would snap it up in a heartbeat. But and really just kind of furthering sectarian division in the process, where you know, a bomb would go off and we'd get, you know, 20 guys brought in, and they were, you know, scared, you know, college students dressed in kind of khakis and in sweaters. And it's like, I don't think these were the dudes, you know, laying in the ditch waiting to have the convoy go past. But then when we were getting attacked by the Iranian militant groups, I mean, the Iraqi security forces would barely lift a finger. So it was, I saw the fact that we cannot get over a lot of those regional tensions, and we especially can't get over it if we're just some big, dumb, lumbering beast in the middle of somebody else's civil war. What happens is you get manipulated by one side or the other. You know, you end up choosing a side, and invariably we choose the wrong one, or we switch halfway through. And the set of shifting alliances and confused priorities means we never really figure out a way to extract ourselves. And, you know, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, you know, while the civilian populace wasn't too keen, all of the relevant actors really wanted us to stay because they were making a ton of money off of us. You know, having the U.S. as a uniting, hated force was super helpful because they could rally their base, and they wouldn't have to, they could rally the base and they could siphon off through corruption and greed and plenty of fraud, waste, and abuse, plenty of funding and sometimes even equipment to attack us with. So, I mean, in both conflicts, and now it's a lot more relevant in Afghanistan, given where the current state of play is in Iraq, the simple reason why we're not going towards peace is because people are making a lot more money off of war than anything stable that could come after. So I'm, you know, I remember having, I had a conversation with a colleague, and I think he was a French NGO worker in Afghanistan, and he kind of turned and worried that even on the humanitarian aid side, it was almost Prozac for dictators, right? I mean, we were keeping things just, you know, not so bad that anyone would be forced to take action, right? I mean, just trying to keep the bottom from falling off. And as a result, they would never actually address those underlying root issues because somebody else was taking care of it. And oftentimes when the U.S. military is as an occupying force, that's what ends up becoming the case, is nobody there actually takes responsibility or accountability for the future of the country because they can just blame the U.S. for whatever goes wrong.
So one thing that's really interesting is you having this experience and this background in the military and in humanitarian aid, and now going to Congress, because Congress has, not you, because you're actually working to redress this, but so many of your colleagues and former colleagues have basically abdicated their constitutional duties when it comes to war. And I think that we wouldn't be getting caught nearly as much in these quagmires if Congress wasn't just giving the president so much authority and neglecting their constitutional duties in terms of war. So I know you've been working on that already. Can you speak about that issue and what you think needs to change?
Now, well, before I get into the AUMFs, one quick aside and a connection I didn't really see until just now. You know, if one of the fundamental issues, you know, for example, in Afghanistan, is that more people are profiting or benefiting, more folks in power are benefiting from a continuation of the conflict than from a cessation, from peace. In Washington right now, all of the reward is around dysfunction, right? You know, if you compromise, if you try to get something done, your side will say you gave up too much, and the other side will say you didn't give up enough. But if you, you know, if you change the frame set where you, or how folks are defining victory, right? in Afghanistan, if the powers that be see victory as continuing to ensure their power, ensure, you know, their ability to profit, in Washington, victory isn't about passing legislation. It's not about moving forward with your agenda or getting the country towards where you feel it should be. All too often, victory is re-election, especially in, you know, safe seats. It's re-election and it's fundraising. Taking back the majority, winning the presidency, those issues are helpful to try to motivate people to give more money. But at the end of the day, that stated goal isn't really aligned with the actions that many people are undertaking. And then we can get to the, you know, issues of the past 2 months in a minute. But specifically on their authorizations for the use of military force, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the post 9/11 AUMF. That, you know, authorized us to go into Afghanistan and still underpins the vast majority of our force projection abroad. You know, so we've bombed four countries since President Biden was inaugurated, and the majority of those military operations have taken place under this authorization for use of military force that's 20 years old and was intended to go after Al-Qaeda and associated forces. And we've broadened that to include not only groups that didn't exist in 2001, but even groups that are actively at war or fighting Al-Qaeda. So it really allows for this sense of mission creep. It allows for a sense of a lack of accountability. I mean, we saw that a few years ago with the killing of four American troops in Niger. And a lot of folks turned around and said, I didn't know we had forces there. Well, we're in a lot of places. And kind of the question that comes to mind is, well, towards what end? And ultimately, are we continuing a perpetuation of involvement by essentially internationalizing what are oftentimes very localized conflicts? We saw this with the Houthis in Yemen. We've seen this in Mali as well. We've seen this with Al-Shabaab. You know, groups that have very regional or even just national ambitions, you know, get put on the level of Al-Qaeda when they're very different threats and addressing very different circumstances. So we're working to reform that. We're working to kind of peel some of that back, because ultimately, if we're sending our forces overseas, we need to have a discussion about that. And there needs to be accountability between the executive and the legislature. And there isn't going to be any of that so long as we continue to just blankly accept that anything can be done under the post 9/11 and Iraq War AUMFs.
Well, and I find it interesting, too, because part of being a conservative has always been about understanding the limits of government, the limits of what government can accomplish, right? Not the progressive utopia where big government can come in and fix all our problems if we just socialized everything. But when it comes to endless adventurism or really hawkish old school Republican foreign policy, it seems to me to run against what Republicans and conservatives are supposed to understand about the inevitable nature of unintended consequences and the limit of what big government, because that's ultimately what a military intervention is, right? It's a drastic exercise of government force and government power. What is that disconnect?
I think you're talking about Chesterton's fence, right? Before you go and rip something out, understand why it was put there in the first place. Case in point, when we removed Saddam Hussein in Iraq, it wasn't exactly a flowery liberation. All it did is it released tensions that had been building or were present but had been kept at bay. I think one of the things that I really felt and saw in both Iraq and Afghanistan was an appreciation for how in the U.S., especially if you're growing up in a, you know, comfortable, you know, middle class or upper middle class setting, if you're living in a suburb, it's a pretty low context environment. You don't need to do a lot to just stay alive and figure out how to get on a path to prosperity. Yeah, you need to work, but it's not. You don't have to be as sharp, as clever, as astute and quick on your feet as if you're living in the midst of, you know, centuries old feuds and, you know, active criminal groups and militants and insurgents. I mean, that in some ways, the simplicity of the majority of American life left our forces really poorly equipped to handle incredibly, not complex in a cultural sense, but just complex in a in a civic sense. Right? I mean, it, sometimes it'd be the soldier from a very small town with kind of a crooked, mayor and, all of these very kind of beneath the surface things that everyone was aware of, to go into a small village in Afghanistan and be like, oh, I recognize this. I see this. But you don't necessarily see that if you grew up in a place that functioned really well. And I think the fatalism in a part of our politics also, it makes us not appreciate how much is actually working. And when folks talk about a revolution, well, guess what happens in a revolution, right? You're not going to get your heart medication. You're not going to get all these things, right? We have maybe a 1 or 2% of things that are going poorly and need to be addressed and fixed. And 98% of things are going pretty well in this country. Obviously, that doesn't mean you excuse the 2%. But when you say you want to burn everything down, appreciate everything that's been built up. And I think that is also an inherently conservative view of realizing that everything we have didn't arrive by accident. And before you start to take something away, appreciate, all the good that it's done.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point too, because I think that the next generation of younger people can be nihilistic, and they can kind of forget that the things we've grown up with didn't just come about because, right? And they want to tear down the systems that got us there. But I bring up this point to ask, because you are 33, which for Congress makes you basically in diapers relative to the boomers and 80-year-olds that call the shots, unfortunately, in most of the halls of power over in Washington. And so I guess one thing I'm curious as a young person, what is it like being in Washington, D.C.? What do you see in terms of being in Congress? What do you see as the disconnects between the current generation that's in power and the next generation?
I think you always have a challenge with generations of assuming that what their experiences were and their professional development is the same as it is today. And I think there's a risk on the flip side too of thinking, well, your experiences don't matter and there's no value or insight you can bring, right? It's that old, chestnut of history not repeating itself but rhyming. It's good if you heard it the first time, because you can kind of at least mumble along and figure out the next. But you also may fail to grasp when something is fundamentally different. And continuing to reach for, when we went through this 10 years ago, it's okay. It's probably going to have some echoes of that, but it may not be 100%. I haven't really found there to be that big a divide, but I've also interacted with, at least I guess on the Republican side of the aisle, Don Young is kind of up there, but it's relatively more youthful. I mean, Republican leadership in the House are, I believe, 52, 53 between Leader McCarthy, Whip Scalise, and Chair Cheney. Obviously on the Democratic side of the aisle, it's very different, where their top three leaders are in either 80, 81, or 82. So I haven't seen as pronounced a generational gap. And frankly, the past couple of years have been humbling to anybody who, thought they had a good grasp of how things function. So in the midst of all that turmoil, sometimes, looking at things through fresh eyes, or at least unencumbered eyes, can be pretty helpful.
So I guess one thing I'm wondering is, it's interesting you point out there is that age discrepancy between Republicans and Democrats. But I've noticed with you and with Congresswoman Nancy Mace and some other people in this new freshman class, the younger kind of future voices and new voices in the House GOP, there seem to be some issues, whether it is LGBT rights, whether it is the environment, or different issues where they just seem to have a different perspective than people in the House Republicans who are 30 years your senior. So I'm wondering if you think that's right, and what those issues are that stand out most clearly in your mind as something where there's just a bit of a different approach with the younger House Republicans.
I mean, I think we've seen that in the country more broadly, right? I mean, in the past 12 years, I mean, where the conversation has gone, or let's say 15 years, where the conversation has gone on gay marriage, on recreational marijuana legalization, and on support for kind of enduring overseas conflicts, I mean, that's done a hard 180, or at least, I mean, it's just come leaps and bounds. I mean, I remember normal, you know, was viewed as some crazy fringe group when I was in, you know, high school 15 years ago. And now, it's not, I mean, the amount of states that have legalized recreational marijuana, I mean, is probably, you know, in the dozens. And I mean, the ironic thing about the Trump administration is they were probably more progressive on LGBTQ issues when they took office, when Donald Trump took office, than Barack Obama was when he took office. So there's a lot of things that have just changed rapidly. But frankly, the largest, and a lot of that has been relatively even among generations. Obviously, the older generations are a little bit more slow to adopt than the younger generations would. But I think when it comes to climate change, that's where you see a tremendous discrepancy, where older generations are much more dismissive and younger generations will rank it as their number one or two issues. And that, to me, is a sign that just demographically, the GOP needs to get in step. But even beyond that, I mean, the Republican Party actually has really good conservation and environmental protection roots. And to me, the conservative approach isn't to gamble on an uncertain future, but to say, what can we do right now to take sensible approaches? Okay, maybe the worst projections won't come true, but you might want to do some of the groundwork just in case, you know, some of the more dire conclusions are borne out. I mean, it just seems like the prudent approach rather than kind of stick your head in the sand and hope it goes away.
Yeah. And so I find this issue, particularly climate change and environmentalism, a really big issue of a divide, because I guess I think of older Republicans having more of the, oh, it's a Chinese hoax approach. And young Republicans, if you look at the polling, really are concerned about climate change. And I think there's an important need for a conservative answer to this so we don't get Green New Deal. Right? Because if everybody wants to address climate change and future generations and worries about what it might mean for our future, well, if the GOP just denies there's a problem and doesn't give us real solutions, whether it's nuclear power, whether it is promoting it through market-based solutions, then the only alternative is AOC and the Green New Deal that we're going to get. So what do you think the counter agenda should and needs to be?
By the way, I couldn't have said that better myself. And, you know, if the only idea on the table is a bad one and you're sitting there saying that's a bad idea, but not offering an alternative, you're not acting in good faith. And in the event someone just needs to pull something off the shelf and ram it through, guess what? You know, you have ensured that that's the only option out there. I'm a very big fan of starting to chunk out this issue. And we're already making, you know, organic progress, you know, with some government incentives on a number of areas. I mean, where the price per watt on solar panels has gone in the past decade is just incredible. And in many parts of the country, even without some of the subsidies, renewable energy, whether it's wind or solar, is reaching grid parity with existing sources. I mean, really, it's just the one of the things that's held back. I mean, we'd have a lot more renewable energy right now if it wasn't for the fact, and I'm not blaming it on this, but just that natural gas prices have been so low. But that's really incredible how rapidly some of those technologies have caught up on efficiency and on just affordability. But I you know, from our energy grid perspective, achieving, you know, to the extent that we can, as much renewable as possible, while recognizing we'll always need an on-demand baseload generating system. And right now, for the money and the carbon footprint, it's hard to beat natural gas. And I'm really optimistic on some of the new nuclear technologies that are coming into the picture as well. So, I mean, that slashes the carbon footprint on energy generation. I think where our grid needs to go as well with expanded electric vehicles, again, when you have more distributed generation, but also especially with renewables, it's not something you can immediately ramp up to meet demand. But you may also have off-peak production. And now when we have fleets of cars sitting at home that can both be charging on the grid during off-peak hours, but also maybe feeding back into the grid during, you know, high peak and high demand hours, you have these ability to buffer that production and consumption cycles that are never going to be, you know, one-to-one organically. I'm also a huge fan of doing what we can on carbon sequestration and carbon capture. I know there was just a bill passed in the last Congress to begin to get some prizes around who can demonstrate the best technologies in that sense. And that's just thinking about how we as a society operate and ways to make things more efficient will ultimately cut waste and save for the American consumer. You know, every product we buy that has something that can't be repurposed or reused is using a diminishing resource and contributing to landfills and pollution. I mean, it's a lot cheaper to keep your water clean than to try to clean it up after it's been contaminated. And I take that approach with the earth as well. I mean, let's do that ounce of prevention today rather than having to pay for the pound of cure down the line.
Yeah, and I think that that's an interesting transition to something I'm curious to get your general framework on economic issues. Obviously, I know that you received an MBA, and you have a business education after your service. And obviously, most young people, or many young people who are on the progressive side, are increasingly socialist leaning, socialist sympathetic, and progressive at the very least. Big government economics, government healthcare for all. And then even on the Republican side, you really do have some voices growing louder who seem to be interested in a nationalist or big government style economic system, just with a conservative spin on it. So I'm wondering where you come down on this, and if you still would call yourself a staunch free market fiscal conservative, or if you fall into one of these different camps.
I mean, I'm open to ideas if it works, if it can be demonstrated, and if it'll arrive at a better outcome. I mean, we look at what's been successful in this country, and you know, there has been usually some hand of the government involved. I mean, we are communicating via the internet, which came out of early research at DARPA. So you have places where, you know, there might be a role on the research and development side, but also if the government had owned the internet, we probably wouldn't be talking on this right now, right? I mean, just you need to allow for competitive forces to take root that are really going to optimize at the end. So I think there's always going to be some role for the government in places where the incentives or the rewards just aren't there yet, but there's a promise. Now, the question is always, how do you make sure that that doesn't get too out of whack? And this is where you see some of the most highly regulated industries or sectors of the economy also being some of the least innovative or the most expensive and the highest rates of inflation in recent years. I mean, just looking at the pocketbook, healthcare, housing, and education are some of the most strictly regulated and have also just seen incredible price increases in the past 20 years. And oftentimes when the solution is, well, education is too expensive, so let's continue subsidizing it, you're just trapped in a vicious cycle of increasingly high prices and then additional subsidies driving even higher prices, driving additional subsidies. And that inefficiency irks me because it ultimately just means the cost is being borne by somebody else. Now, there's going to be places, and healthcare is a great example, where if it was a purely capitalist system, there are some people who the system wouldn't look at and value their life, right? So we have to have some kind of moral buffer. But when you over-index on that, you lead to a system that under-delivers and underperforms for all. And to me, that's equally immoral when you're failing to meet the responsibilities. So it's a fine line. And I think oftentimes, you know, conservatives, it can be challenging to communicate, listen, I think this is a moral good. This is a good for society. My issue is the government doing it will not address the problem, you know, and that sort of semantic slippage between, oh, well, you don't think that $15 minimum wage is a great example, right? Well, you don't think people should be paid a living wage. I absolutely believe people should be paid a living wage. I also don't think we should be satisfied with the minimum wage being someone's, you know, terminal income capacity. But when we try to just manipulate one simple component, and that's really all the attention span really allows in the news economy, when you try to just manipulate one simple component, you may achieve, you know, some marginal benefits in one area and plenty of unintended and negative consequences in others.
So one interesting and kind of related issue is the national debt, which it seems like Republicans used to care a lot about and some still do. But I'm wondering if you, being on the younger side, like me, have more salience to this issue than perhaps Republicans have in the last couple of years, where they put it on the back burner, because this is $27 trillion and counting that's going to be hanging over our heads the rest of our life, meaning higher taxes, lower economic growth, less investment because of crowding out, all sorts of adverse consequences. And that doesn't mean we have to end all spending tomorrow and create an anarcho-capitalist utopia, but obviously we got to take it seriously, in my view at least. So I'm wondering what you think, and if you think that young Republicans like yourself in Congress are going to maybe push on the need for action on this, because ultimately it's our generation that's going to be on the hook, not the ones who are on the way out right now.
No. There's nothing that leaves me more despondent than the state of our national debt and just the fact that there's no positive trend lines moving forward on debt and deficit spending. It's hard to sit there, you know, especially after the past 4 years, and complain about Democratic spending. You know, we don't really have much of a leg to stand on. I mean, yes, we're absolutely fiscal hawks when we're in the minority and don't have to actually take responsibility for government programs. But I think one of the challenges is that when it's been, and frankly, this is maybe the Republican equivalent of the Green New Deal in terms of messaging and fatalism. You know, if you keep saying the sky is going to fall, it doesn't mean you're wrong. You might just be early. And if we're saying the sky is going to fall around the debt and the deficit, you know, 20 years ago, and now, you know, we're just at unfathomable levels of public debt to GDP, you know, something is going to give. I'm going to caveat everything with saying that what our specific public debt to GDP is within the U.S. also has to be looked at in terms of global debt to GDP, because, you know, we live in a global market, and currency trading can go every which way. We still have the global reserve currency for now, but we can only take that for granted for so long. I don't want to over ascribe to these theories, but it's interesting that the more government spending is announced, the more the Bitcoin price starts to rise.
Bitcoin.
Believe me, if there was one way to get me to leave a room, it's to talk about cryptocurrency. And that's not saying there isn't something legitimate there. It's that I've yet to talk to many people who can elucidate a very clear understanding of their beliefs and its intrinsic value. But just that idea of some alternative will put us in a tough place. I mean, I think that just the fact that COVID hit around the world and that there's a lot of other governments going into similar, you know, kind of, you know, deficit spending that's driving up their debt, it lessens our individual risk. But you also want to be in a stronger position. And we're just not in a strong position on this front at all. I mean, it's going to drag on our future growth. The rates of spending that we're seeing under the American Rescue Plan, I'm very confident. I shouldn't say I'm very confident. I would not be surprised at all. And I'm anticipating that we'll see an inflationary environment on the tail end of this that will echo back to what we saw during the Carter administration. We're just in such uncharted territory. And then you see intellectual fig leaves like modern monetary theory coming in to basically excuse away any concern about government spending. And you know, this doesn't seem like a wise path to be on. But frankly, unless we get control of healthcare costs, specifically, you know, on the entitlement side, but also amongst other government programs, we're never going to be able to fully address that.
So I think that may just be a good place to leave the serious talk. So hopefully now I think my listeners have a good understanding of where you're coming from. And I think you're one to keep an eye on for the future in terms of the GOP. So the thing is, though, this is going to be make or break with a lot of my listeners. Your hot food take, is it hot enough? Do they agree with it? Or is it like one of mine that they generally think are trash and terrible takes? So go ahead and hit our audience with your hot food take, Congressman.
You know, I think Donald Trump... I don't know if you mentioned it directly, but it was referenced in an article, and I really wish you would have elaborated on it because I think you would have found support in surprising corners. But I think he agrees with me that breakfast is a garbage meal. I do not understand for the life of me folks who sing the praises of all day breakfast, breakfast for dinner, breakfast for lunch. I mean, it is like eggy, greasy, cheesy, right? Which I love some of those components in the right balance. Are you going to tell me that scrambled eggs are some amazing meal? I mean, I want more complexity. I want more flavors. I don't want just something super simple. I will eat pizza for breakfast. I have no issue. That's, looked down upon by society, even though it is there are flavors there, right? What are the flavors in like a ham and cheese biscuit? Like an egg and cheese biscuit. Like it is.
See, I love pancakes. That's my thing.
Even
maple syrup.
I'm not saying I haven't had a good breakfast meal every now and then, but I refuse to buy into this hegemonic theory that your stomach can only take super simple flavors and at a certain time of day. When it comes to breakfast, count me out. I mean, I'll do cereal. I'll do cereal, but it's a functional choice, right? It's not for joy. And I'm not, going to go out to a restaurant and be like, oh my gosh, cereal's on the menu, right? Like some of the all day breakfast stuff. So if that gets me canceled, so be it. I'd rather be
based. We'll see hashtag Fire Meyer trending after this, and you'll click on it and you'll be like, okay, it's just about the breakfast thing. No, I'm kidding. But I don't agree with that one, but I feel like some people might be sympathetic to it. And with that, I will let you go. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Congressman.
Really appreciate it, Brad. Thank you for your time.